This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
That's nice. Thank you.
But do you find, like, you know, a lot of bulls have crazy bugles.
Yeah, I mean, they're spread across the board.
Sometimes you have some bull, he'd be like, ah, you know.
The ones that sound like they broke their larynx somehow.
Yeah, we were in, not to diverge too quick, too fast, but I was in the Bob Marshall in 2012, and the place is untouched, basically, in some of these areas. And we had a bull that beagled that sounded like an owl. That I would have never believed it if he didn't answer me like five, you know, within that 5 second range. And he did it again and it was like an owl hooting. I'm like, what?
Can you give me an example?
I almost can't. And then
just do it without a call, but just do it or come as close as you can to mimicking what he's doing.
But yeah. Not even really that thump. It's just kind of an owl hoot sound. And then on that same day, we walked a half mile down the ridge and one sounded like a donkey. And it did it twice, like a hee-haw type sound. I'm like, wow, this is, I felt like I was in some crazy land. Like these aren't elk anymore, but we called them both in to 25 yards and like, no, they were elk and they bugled that way the whole way in. Just crazy. All kinds of sounds.
When you're out, you know, that's kind of what I guess I'm getting at is like, we talked about this a bunch this spring when we were all hot on talking about turkeys is, you know, you work so hard to get the right sounds. You know, you work so hard to get like high level turkey calling, like, which I'm not great at. But then when you're out in the turkey woods, birds will come in doing stuff that, you know.
Yeah, just crazy.
They'll come in, like we had a guy, after we had this conversation, we had a guy send us a video. It was the hen that comes in and like, I think it yelped like 27 times in a row.
Oh, I thought it was in the 60s.
It was just like
nonstop. Yeah.
Where everybody's like, well, you should never yelp more than, you know,
yeah, and if
five
I was,
to seven times.
And if we sat out in the woods and we're leaning against a tree and my body's going to start calling and he gets going and he hits 60, right? You'd be looking at him like, what in the world are you doing?
Yeah.
So in the bugling thing, like when you're ripping bugles like that, do you mess around with doing the crazy ones or do you think it works best to have like that clean, really like quintessential escalating topped out pitch bugle, like the perfect bugle? So, or do you rip crazy bugles too?
So when I'm locating, so that's just my standard walking down the ridgeline, I try to get that high note that rings your ears. And I do that one the same every time, you know, call me boring, vanilla ice cream. Just, I'm going to get the high note. I'm going to get the high note. I'm going to get the high note. But once I get in on a bull, then I try to, and that's where I think becoming a good caller may help, is I try to mimic that bull exactly. If he is that weird donkey bull or whatever, I might mimic him. Or
Do you really?
If it gets that crazy, maybe not. But most of your bulls that I would say within your general sounds, like if they're a lip baller, which is the bugle I just did, that real knocky bugle through the center. If they're a high note with two chuckles, I try to match him. So I just try to kind of match the bull I'm trying to call in and mimic him. Once we get into that situation, but for my location bugles, when I'm trying to just get something to answer, I'm pretty just plain Jane, two or three note, as high as I can get, you know, send it down the canyon and then listen.
If you had to choose for locating elk, if I said you can bring your binoculars, you can bring optics or you can bring a bugle, you're going with the bugle.
Ooh, oh man.
That's a good question.
All the seminars I do, my preferred way to spot them, I'm going to give you the easiest answer ever here. I'm going to tell you why each.
Give it to me from the game caller perspective.
No, I would much rather spot elk with my binoculars any day over top of than locating them with a bugle. That way they don't know I'm in the world. I can sit and watch them and figure out what's going
on. That's a good point.
But if I had to leave my locator bugle, if I can't spot them within the first half hour of the day, then I'm screwed because now I need that location bugle the rest of the for the next 2 or 3 hours of that morning to try to get something going. So neither of them are good, but I would say, man, I would probably leave the optics. If I had to pick, I'd take the location bugle.
Yeah. And again, I think two things that would be major factors would be like, is it September or is it November?
Yeah.
Right?
No. Yeah. I'm talking like
September
hunting. Hunting, man.
Yeah. So I'm the only reason I'm hoping that if I bring my location bugle, I can either spot them with naked eye, is there elk out in the middle of a opening, hopefully close, or they're going to be sounding off on their own. So I don't want to necessarily leave that location bugle at the truck. I'll leave my binoculars.
Yeah. So, and to add to that, I feel like, again, we're going to make a lot of call outs to turkeys, but like both of those animals are like much like sort of more fun and easier to hunt when they're making sounds. And when they clam up, you're like, it's completely two different things, yeah. Right? And sometimes with elk, you really have to be hammering to get them to start talking.
Yep.
You know?
What are the, when you do a standard, your standard locator bugle? Well, first, can you explain what you mean by a locator bugle, just so people are tracking?
So, you know, and we can get into the science, and I don't claim to know.
No, I don't even mean, like, yeah. I'm going to have you dissect a bugle. But I mean, like, when you say, like, locating, just tell people what you mean by that.
So, it's the idea that I'm going to pronounce that I'm an elk, I'm up here on this ridgeline, and I'm just looking for a response. And it's kind of a territorial thing. That herd bull, or even that other satellite bull, you say, hey, I'm up here, and he'll answer, I'm down here, kind of that Marco Polo game. You know, so to speak, like Marco Polo. All right, now I got you. That's, you know, you didn't know I wasn't a real elk, so now I can start the game, you know, figure out where the wind's at. And so you're just looking for a response. You're not trying to call them in. You're not trying to threaten them, scare them, anything at that point. It's just kind of a
get quick, their GPS
coordinates. Yeah, just a quick clean. All right, now I got a pin on you. We'll figure out how to, you know, try to get on, you know.
And that raises a couple other questions. Real quick, tell people what a satellite bull is.
So satellite bull, it's just that bull that's kind of hanging close to that herd bull. The herd bulls, typically, they've got their pecking order figured out. That herd bull, anywhere from, you know, it could be a single cow, two cows in some places when the bull to cow ratio is high, all the way down to, in my area in coastal Washington, you have herds of 25, 30, and it's not even unheard of to have more cows than that.
Where that so one that, big boss bull is kind of running the show.
Yep.
Or like the, you know, there's like a lead cow running. There's a lead cow who's saying like, we're going here,
yep.
But pestering them and corralling yeah. them and yeah. defending them from all comers.
Yeah.
She's like the chief bull.
Yeah. She tells them where they're going. He kind of tells them how they're going to get there.
Who's going to come along.
Yeah. Yeah. And he keeps them rounded up. But then these satellite bulls are your, you know, subordinate, submature, sometimes even mature bulls. You know, if you get into some of these spots, you might have a giant satellite bull body wise and age wise, maturity wise. But that herd bull's big enough and more dominant enough to keep them just kind of on the shadows of this herd bull. What happens throughout the day and throughout September, these satellite bulls come in and try to pick off a cow or two from them. And so this herd bull spends a ton of time like running them off. And you know, when you run off a satellite bull, now there's, you know, there's sometimes multiple satellite bulls. They're coming to pester from the opposite direction, almost like they're working against him to, you know, pick cows out of his herd. So you got these satellite bulls, and it becomes very, very fun elk hunting when that happens, because that herd bull becomes very, very active, very, very talkative. The satellite bulls get very, very talkative and active, and it kind of creates that rut frenzy that yeah. just, you know.
I've heard guys talk time. About, I haven't seen this personally, but I've heard guys talk about like a herd bull being so fixated on chasing and harassing other bulls that they're watching as all these other bulls are slipping in and breeding a cow.
Yep.
And instead of just like breeding the cow, he just can't help himself but just chase everyone all over the place and just open himself up
yeah.
to having like the very thing he's trying to prevent from happening. He's basically allowing it to happen by running other bulls 100 yards in some direction all the time. You
yeah.
know?
And we've watched them from across the canyon. It's almost like they've got that herd bull will pick out one or two he really doesn't like, you know, like us. He's got his worst enemy, and he'll spend more time. He'll let those other bulls get so much closer to his herd and spend more time on that one bull. It seems like, man, you're letting these other ones slip in. It's just, I don't know what goes through their head, but
some are like, they're like fighters and not lovers. Man.
Yep. Yep.
What do you think about this? Like if you're out locating, Kane, you're up, I you know, presume you like to be up high.
Yep.
Where you can broadcast down as much ground as you can. When you see a bull, I'm trying to think of how to ask this. A bull doesn't go up high. A real bull doesn't go up high and rip out bugles just to see who's out on the landscape, right?
Yep.
He's doing something different.
Yeah.
He's not like, hey, where are you? Because I'm going to come 400 yards over that direction and beat your ass, you know? Like, what is he communicating when he's bugling?
So, what we're trying to mimic, in my opinion, with that ridge running, you know, or fire road running, whatever, that get high so you can really use, you know, the terrain to your advantage. Satellite bulls will do that, especially those somewhat mature satellite bulls, or they will run ridges looking for those cows. And so when we had the chance to hunt,
but what are they doing? What are they bugling for?
They're just trying to locate cows. In the real world, us removed, that satellite bull is running looking for, like, hey, I'm here, and you know, without us being involved, that cow would come to him.
Oh, so you think they really are up there cruising, bugling, and bugling trying to find elk, not just bugling as a way of being, I have them.
Yep.
I mean, I'm going to hang on to them.
We were in the Blues in 2014 down there in Southeast Washington, where it's a little bit different of a, you know, it's a special draw. The elk are a lot more active. There's a lot more of them. On multiple occasions, we would be in the timber and heard that happen, where you could hear a bull run a finger ridge up, run the main ridge out, run a finger ridge down, and he was just bugling as fast as he could run.
By himself.
And we ended up calling him in, and calling that bull in, and the shooter missed it a couple times. We watch it across.
You're talking the Blues in Washington.
Yeah.
Washington State.
We watch the same thing across the way. You would watch a herd bull just, and you could hear him. You would watch him just run a ridge line and bugle every couple hundred yards. I think he was just flat out looking for cows. He had none. Just running ridges looking for elk.
So he's like a boss gobbler out.
I was just gonna say, it's amazing the similarities.
Well, Yanni doesn't like it when people say he doesn't like it when people say that elk hunting's like turkey hunting.
No.
Rami doesn't like it because, admittedly, there are some enormous differences.
Yep.
Right. Just the gut pile. Right. Just the gut pile alone.
Yeah,
a little different.
Yeah, some of these Western hunters, some of us Western hunters, not us, me included, but some people have some issues with that comparison, the whole elk versus turkey. But
there's more dudes hunt turkeys than hunt elk.
Yep.
And when you're hunting turkeys, you're out being like, there's a vocal male, okay? There's a vocal male who's territorial, who doesn't like other males, who wants hens to come to him. You're making the noise of females. It's like, I'm sorry. But there's like some similarities.
Yeah.
More than in duck hunting. No one says elk hunting's like duck hunting.
No, I think you're exactly on point. As far as the calling aspects and kind of what's going through your head, what's going through their head, they're pretty dang close. You know, I think the dissimilarities are, you know, the terrain you're in, maybe how difficult the hunt is. But there's some tough turkey hunting too.
Shitloads of differences. Yeah. Antlers.
Yeah.
Right? There's all these things. And it's funny because I would never, like, let's say I hung out with some dude who had always hunted elk. Okay. And he's out for his first turkey hunt. I wouldn't be like, bro, it's just like hunt, right? It only goes the other direction because you're trying to invite people who have a familiarity. You know, the millions of individuals who have a familiarity with turkey hunting, you're kind of just trying to invite them to start thinking about the whole thing.
Yep.
So it's not meant to be an insult. Like I said, you know, you can fit a turkey's gut pile in your pocket, in your back pocket.
Yeah.
The elk, you got to have a wheelbarrow for that thing.
A lot of the tactics, I feel like, if you're strictly talking the hunting, the calling, it's pretty similar.
Yeah.
But back to the cows, though, responding to, I've twice had it running ridges, bugling away, and a bugle, and like the last thing you think you're going to hear is yeah, and sure enough, like, you know, less than 100 yards away, I have a cow answer me.
Her coming into the bugle.
But what's interesting, both times that happened, I mean, it was right on the back end of that cow call, is then the bull that was with her went and was like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So both times I heard crashing away. That bull took that cow and was like, we're going that direction.
Came up, hooked her, and took her the other way.
So let me ask you this then, both of you guys. Have you seen many instances when you're out ridge running, what do you call it? You're just out locating on the ridges, ridge running. Have you called in many bull-less cows doing that?
Not a lot. I say you're just looking for that location because typically we get that location beagle and we bail off towards him. But no, I would say,
but get what I'm after.
Yeah. Though. Yeah. If that's the way that real life works. No. And I think even the satellite bull, and this is just my own thoughts on it. There's not a lot of loose cows running, you know, or unherded up cows running around. I think, but for that satellite bull, it's worth that last ditch effort to run those ridges and just see what's out there. Another thing, a reason that, and they could be very similar to us, that somewhat mature satellite bull could be looking for a different herd. Like, hey, I can't take that guy down there's cows because he's a big, you know, he's the toughest guy on the mountain. But maybe there's a herd bull on the other side or down here in a different pocket that's maybe not as tough, and I have a chance at him. You know, so there may be a couple different reasons. He may be just searching for, you know, loose cows or a different herd bull to go try to fight.
Yeah, that's easy for me to picture, is that he's just out ripping bugles. And when he hears something, he's like, what the hell? I'm going to go over there and have a look, see what's going on.
Yeah.
Maybe some dinky little shit, and I'm going to clobber him. And then he'll be up running ridges, and I'll be down here playing grab ass.
Yeah, he already did the hard work for me. He's got these things all rounded up. I just got to scoop in. And
that's my friend Brant would talk about up in Anchorage, Alaska. He would talk about these big mallards that would hang around on campus where they had some open ponds and stuff. And they'd be up there and they'd just get fat, you know, these huge big mallards. And then the migratory ducks would come up and they'd just be emaciated, you know, from that long migration. He said they'd land in that big local duck, be like, I'll take him here, boys. And then just take over all the hens, you know.
Yeah.
He's just totally fat and happy. What are the parts of a bugle?
So there,
do you think about it in that way?
I do, and there's different ways to mix and match. Kind of, there's your opening. You can, a lot of the people start off with a growl, or you know, a real. I say we should talk about real bulls. A real bull will start off, you know, raspy or growly, which we can mimic with adding some voice in with our throat.
Yeah, do the whole thing, and then I'll have you break out some parts. Let's just do, because we haven't had you rip one since we started talking.
So just kind of a hero will do a kind of a standard challenge. We all try to think about the different parts that are in there, and at least what I do, and then we'll come back and try to explain them.
I'm going to try to count how many parts I think are in there. I like that end, man, because when you watch someone do it and you see his belly just...
Yeah, drop. Yeah,
oh, and then, it's cool.
And they're pissing all over themselves. And
yeah, look, when they get like that, man, they look like they'd be eating meat. You can picture them just like killing a rabbit and eating it when they're up ripping those out, their belly just going. And yeah, it's like, you're like, yeah, at some point you'd switch diets almost, man, you know? So you got like
Yeah, there's that opening, which I typically don't do the growly. I usually just start clean.
Clean into the escalation.
Yeah. And then you kind of transition really quick into your high note. So you can kind of, there's that intro, the transition into the high note. I try to hold that high note for, you know, 1 or 2 seconds. And it depends on what bugle. Maybe we should just, so there's that location bugle, which is just a 2 or 3 note, high note, and then quit. So there's only maybe 2 or 3 parts of the location. The challenge bugle I just did. And then halfway through that high note, I try to drop my voice back into the call. So and then you try to like get growly there towards the end. And that's just kind of my idea of adding some aggression back in. And then I finish with the grunt. So intro, get to the high note, add some voice back in, either finish with some chuckles, grunts, or you can just kind of pop the bugle off and end it there.
And you found like on the locations, like when you're doing locators, you found that like extending, prolonging that highness, the high note, can fire them up more than when you don't.
I wouldn't say extending it. I would say it's that tone you reach. Making sure you get that tone that hits your ears.
Because it somehow gets their attention.
I don't like to, and the length of it, I actually don't like to be that long. I want to be like 2 or 3 seconds, because there's a chance that bull may do a weird grunt or do like a weird little answer, or a cow may answer somewhere in there. And if I'm ripping a bugle, I can't necessarily hear that. You know, like some of those ones in the Bob Marshall, for instance, they were very quick because I don't know if they've ever heard a bugle in their life or there's not a lot. And they were answering like literally, I would barely catch a tail end of their responses. And I'm like, what the heck was that again? You know,
that's a good point.
So you want to keep that bugle, in my opinion, 2 to 3 seconds and then listen.
But talk about what you were telling me with you and a buddy watching elk and trying to get them to respond.
Which story was that?
You were just talking about you guys were doing different types of bugles, and there were certain types of bugles that would make him fire up, and some that he would ignore.
Yeah, so we run in areas. It's obvious as we're running these ridge lines, like there's elk here. You could see fresh tracks. You could smell them. They smell like one of those big black markers. You know, they just have a unique smell. You're like, man, there are elk here. They can hear us from right here. They were here this morning.
It's like a barnyard with like kind of a sweet, nice.
Yeah, and then the big bulls, I think when they're flat out going, there's those big like super 44 black markers that have that just pungent smell. Like that's what I always imagine. Like there's a big bull here somewhere.
That's funny you say that, man, because I always said that antelope, like pronghorn antelope, They smell like Frito-Lay corn chips, man, when you put your nose up to their fur, you know.
Yeah.
Black marker for elk.
Yep. Black, big, that big Magnum 44 marker, whatever the heck it is. It's like that. Anyways, that's just what I think about.
I get you, man.
But yeah, on that hunt, we knew there were elk. And so me and my buddy, we're just experimenting. Like, hey, you, Beagle, he's not quite as loud as me, but Beagle, and then, but don't get the high note. Like, just stay somewhere in the middle. And he would do that and nothing. He'd maybe let him do it twice. And then I would come in with that high note that just kind of rattles your ears, rattles your buddy's ears, makes you kind of want to plug your ears during that Beagle, because it's just that resonance is that one that drones in your ears, and we get an instant response. Like, all right, let's do this scientifically. We need to switch up. So next time I'm going to go just hit a mundane mid note, just boring. And then you'll hit the high note just to make sure it's not volume or something else that we're doing. And sure enough, I wouldn't get a response on a mid note bugle. He'd hit the high note and bam, just the instant response. And I think there's very, very good data just from our own selves. And you hear a lot of hunters like, yeah, until I can get that high note, we just don't get responses.
So there's something about it that makes them pay attention to
it. Yeah. Maybe it penetrates better, you know, through the thick brush. It travels better. Something is better about it that gets them. Maybe it's just internally, like they hear that note and like, hey, I'm going to answer that one.
Yeah. Because that's the funny thing about it is like, you'll never know what kind of trip they're on.
Yep.
You'll never know, like when they hear it, what are they hearing? I've mentioned this before, but I was talking to a friend of mine who's done a lot of research on turkeys, right? And he's talking about the iridescence of birds, you know? And he believes that when a bird looks at a bird, it sees something very different than when you look at a bird. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like you can't compare your impression of what a turkey looks like walking through the woods to what it might look like a turkey. With his vision, what's in his mind, the iridescence of the feathers, the way he picks up that color. And it's like, it's just two different worlds, you know. Little things can sort of give you a glimpse into it, but you just don't know what kind of trip they're on.
Yep.
You don't know how they're like analyzing or processing the information around them.
And there's a, I kind of cater more to the temperament of the elk in my calling style. I kind of I react to them. There are quite a few guys out there that have, kind of broken down elk language or maybe what some of this stuff means, and they're successful. So I'm not necessarily going to argue with them, but I was kind of a nerd at this stuff when I was growing up, you know, 18 to 25, I spent way more time than a single person should ever spend just watching elk, you know, from mid September to mid October, back when I was a rifle / muzzleloader hunter. I just wanted to know everything about them. Why are they doing this? And I would just watch bulls day in and day out. And, you know, some of these sounds that they say mean this, I'm like, but I seen them do complete opposites. You know, when he chuckles, that means that he's trying to round the cows up to take them somewhere else. I seen a satellite bull come down the ridge and he went and chuckled at him. Like, so some of these things, like it may be, but it could just be his temperament. It could be the way he communicates. It could be, so why, like I said, these guys have been successful, but I don't know if I necessarily, it's 100% that this sound means this or this sound means you should do this. It's tough, and I don't know if we'll ever figure it out.
Can you do, I want you to make a warning bark. But then I also want to ask you, like, in terms of people are like, oh, so chuckling is this. Chuckling means I'm sending my cows. But then you're like, well, I saw a bull chuckle at another bull. So maybe that's not what chuckling means. So do a warning call, but also tell me, have you ever seen a warning bark used for something besides saying, hey, there's a coyote, hey, there's a dude, hey, I smelled something funny?
So you want me to bugle first?
Whatever order you want, man. Oh, I hate that noise. I hate that noise even when you make it.
I that's why in the seminars, I'm like, besides a wolf howling, that's about the second least favorite sound I'd like to hear in my elk hunting spot, with wolves being first. But so that sound, I'm more confident in what that means. They typically, when they smell you, they're gone. You don't even get the warning bark. But it's one of these, they've seen something they don't like or they've heard something they don't like. You know, if we're tromping around through the woods and we're cracking sticks, all of a sudden you think you're an elk and, you know, you get hammered with an alarm bark. I think it's one of those sounds that, and I'm fairly confident in this, that they want you to show yourself at that point. Like, we seen or heard something that doesn't make a lot of sense. We're a little bit worried about it. Come show yourself. And I think that's why, in response to that alarm bark, I alarm bark back. Like, well, I heard
you.
I heard you, or I seen you. You come show yourself. And a lot of times you can at least prolong,
right,
prolong her running away or him running away, alarm barking the rest of the canyon, letting everything know, hey, there's something weird going on over here. But sometimes we've been able to alarm bark and have like the cow come around the tree.
Really?
You know, some stuff that could have potentially saved that if it was a bull or an elk I wanted to kill.
Do you remember? Oh, go ahead.
I think it can kind of almost confuse them because she is, I feel like most of the time it's cows. I've heard a couple bulls bark
mostly,
too.
Mostly cows.
Like, they're saying one thing, and then when you bark back at them, they're kind of like, oh, what? But wasn't expecting that. Oh, there's an elk barking, and it kind of just like, I've seen them not really relax, but like you saying, instead of just like getting the hell out of Dodge barking, they sort of just like end up just filtering slowly away, and you maybe haven't blown your cover.
We've definitely confused whitetails and confused antelope by doing their bark back at them.
Right.
You know? And then they're kind of, they linger more.
Yeah, they just kind of hang out. It's not necessarily you didn't save the whole situation, but it gives you a chance.
Yeah.
But you know what? You remember those, you remember the bite and blow, like the Primos bite and blow that everyone in the world had, like in the mid-90s?
Yep.
I think that that was, like, enough people had it, and it made such a consistent sound every time. I'm not joking when I say this. We would blow that, and cows would respond with an alarm bark.
Good, yeah.
If they're like, that means one thing. Yeah. That means there's some dudes. There's some dudes in the woods, man.
Yeah.
And I was like, that was having that experience a couple times of like, get all set up. Everything's perfect. Wind's perfect. Okay, we're going to call the bull in and hit that, meow, you know, on that bite and blow. And then be answered by, rah, rah.
Bark back.
Dude, it set us back.
I got to say, before you chime in on this, that like, I had that call. I might even be in that Tupperware over there. And I could just never master it. I could never get it good. It was just like, it was too finicky, you know? It was kind of like you never could, like these external reads that you make now, I mean, you can like.
Yeah, but you got to be good to use them. I think people like that because you could be a shitty caller and kind of make a noise. But every shitty caller was making the same shitty noise.
Right,
and
that's
I think,
the thing. It necessarily wasn't making a good noise.
Yeah. And that's like my dad. He still can't use my Easy Estrus. You know, everybody else in the world can, but he could use the bite and blow. So like Steve said, you throw him one of those, all you gotta do is bite and blow on it and you're good.
Bite and blows are like crossbows. Right? It's like some dudes being like, man, I don't really have time to figure all this shit out.
Yeah.
Right. I'm just gonna get one of those and go hack it out.
Yeah, I ran around with I think it was the Lohmann version, the little green barreled one, the bite and blow, and that's what I used growing up, rifle hunting, just a stop one or.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you could not change what you sounded like. You sounded like everybody else that had one.
Yeah, and they just tune in, especially if you're in a high pressure area.
Yep.
But that's pretty interesting, man, that you've I would never in a million years thought to hit them back with the warning bark.
Yep. Yeah.
Do you guys call it a bark in your neck of the woods?
Yeah. You know, alarm bark. And we've had enough experiences where we've tried to like, let's just mew at them. And that seems to never work as good as alarm bark. So we've experimented like, well, if we call back to them, maybe they just want to hear that there's an elk. It was an elk that made the sound. So if I make a good enough elk sound, but it doesn't settle them down as much as the alarm bark.
They're already
so
committed to the idea that something's amiss. Yeah. Man. A funny thing about elk too, I'd be curious to get your perspective on this, is it seems like, if you picture a group of whitetails, I feel that the hierarchy in a group of whitetails isn't as, I'm talking the females, so does, like whitetail does. I feel like the hierarchy isn't as rigid as it is with elk. There's more fluidity with the groups. Because a thing that I found with elk, watching elk, is there's some elk that you can alert. Like, let's say you're putting a sneak in on a group. And there's some elk that they pick up that something's not right. But no one cares that they think something's not right.
You're spot on.
They got their head up and they're like, bro, I saw something, man. I know I saw something. And the other elk are still feeding.
Yep.
There's some elk, they lift their head up and everyone's head comes up.
Exactly. And
they're like, something's amiss. Because old Bessie ain't happy. When she ain't happy, nobody's happy, right?
No, you're exactly spot on. And we've got hundreds, if not thousands of, you know, a calf or a yearling can pick their head up. know something's not right. She can run to the front of the herd and nothing cares. But if you get one of those more adult cows, she'll run up, bump that lead cow, and it's all over. Or if the lead cow sees you don't have a shot. But sometimes these younger cows may not have as much influence. I don't know what it is. But yeah, a calf will pick you up. She'll run circles in the herd, try to get them all, and nobody, none of the other cows care. Nothing happens. So
no,
I think they're
no street cred yet.
Yeah.
I've mentioned this before on the show, but these researchers were doing a thing with monkeys one time where they destroyed a monkey's credibility in his troop by recording his warning cry and playing it all the time. And after a while, when he would do his legit warning cry, no one would pay attention because they gave him the reputation of the boy who cries wolf.
That's crazy.
And these things had a pretty elaborate language where they would have a warning cry for something on the ground and a warning cry for something in the air. Because there was like some, I can't remember what it was, or some, one of their primary predators, their leopards were a primary predator, and there's some just big avian predator. And they would have that noise, and they could make it that people lost their faith, where his troop lost their faith in him. I don't think that probably happens with elk, but they haven't earned it yet.
Yeah.
Or they're like jumpy. Maybe they have a reputation for being jumpy.
That old Bessie, she's just a crazy one. She didn't see anything again.
Because there's nothing that feels better when you're putting the move on something. Well, what feels better is not spooking one. But if you're putting the move on something and he pegs you and you freeze and all of a sudden it goes back to feeding. And you're like, man, back in the game, But they're still in their head. They're still like acutely aware.
Yeah.
Right. They're still nervous. But you like bought a minute.
Yeah.
You bought a kind of a second chance,
Yeah. Yeah, that lead cow, though, there's no... I wish there was a way that you could, like, tie a big pink ribbon around the lead cow, and then she could never be killed. Because around home, there's been some bad... Like, the whole herd just loses their sense of who they are, where they're safe. And, like, you see, some of our cow seasons where that lead cow gets shot, that entire herd is in trouble from groups of hunters because they forget how to be safe second. And so that's like my conservation. Like, I wish there was a way we could tie like a pink ribbon around all the herd cows or the lead cow's neck and she can't ever be shot. Because she controls so much of their safety.
There's cows out there that have 18, 20 years worth of experience.
Yep.
They've been through the season that many times. They've been through winter that many times.
You wouldn't think, though, because there's got to be, if she's there then with her offspring and the rest of her, there's got to be the next class, right, that's 16 years old.
You would think. I mean, in that age bracket. But it's funny. We've seen it enough around home. I live in a very small community with a very, small tree farm in my backyard, the Weyerhaeuser South there in PL. And, like in those muzzleloaders or some of the late archery seasons when that herd, that lead cow gets shot, it's a mess. Like, and then you'll just hear of like six or seven or eight cows that get taken out of that herd just because it's, even though there may be, maybe a cow her same age, older, younger, I don't know how that pecking order is determined, but it's just like, dang, that new one wasn't very good at, or the second or third one wasn't very good at keeping them safe.
Yeah. Or hadn't done it yet. And the other ones haven't paid attention.
Yeah.
Do you, when you're hunting, are you kind of watching? Do you find yourself watching to try to see who the lead cow is when you're trying to work a group of elk that's got a bull in it?
A little bit, like more from afar. When we're in the timber and stuff, getting in close, it's tough. It's tough to figure out which one is because they're kind of spread out, mingling.
Until they're in action or moving.
But if we spot one across the canyon, we're definitely paying attention. Like, how much control does she have? Is she setting the pace? How long till they get into the patch of timber where they're going to bed? So we'll pay attention to her, or is she more just slowly grazing? A little bit, but not a lot to what that lead cow is doing.
Once you're up, and let's just walk through and say, like, you're up, you're doing your locating, and lo and behold, not terribly far off, but still far off, you get a reply. What's the next piece of information you want to know, or like, what's the next thing you do?
Real quick, I'll look at maybe Onyx maps. Maybe if I can't see exactly where that came from, like, is there a bench down there? What's going on terrain wise? What time of day is it? Are my thermals switched for good? If it takes me an hour to get down there and that's when the sun's going to hit the canyon, am I going to get caught in this wind, this wind swirl? And then where are they going? Is it, if it's right at daybreak, they're probably going to feed, you know, typically for a little bit and then head to bed. So I'm trying to figure out, all right, they're maybe heading this direction. I've got this much time to get there. But first of all, I want to make sure I don't get the wind screwed up. What am I going to have to do to get the wind right? Do I have to scoop under them? Do I need to run down this ridge another 200 yards, go down a finger and then get under them? Should I just sit down and wait for an hour for the wind to fully switch and then go straight down on them? You know, it's some of this stuff all kind of time of day. But typically I'm bailing off on every elk I hear. I don't say, oh, that one sounds like it's not very big. I'm going to just find a bigger one. Yeah. I'm going to at least go check with my eyes, see what's down there. So we're pretty much diving after every bugle. If that's all I can hear, if I can't see them.
Let me give you a couple like competing scenarios. Okay. Let's do the first. First scenario will be like the one that I would like least. It's 10 in the morning. It's hot. You rip a bugle. And then from the nastiest patch of black matchstick timber, seems like it's right in the middle of the nastiest patch of black timber. Are you like, man, I'm just going to wait? Or do you think I'm going to go in there and try to work that bull?
How can I get close to the black timber without making a whole bunch of noise?
Yep.
All right, I'm going to go down.
It's like a north-facing slope. And there's a patch of black timber in there that's, I don't know, you know, hundreds of yards tall, hundreds of yards wide.
I'm going to go down and sit on the edge. I love killing elk between 10 or 2 when that bull bugles out of his bed somewhere around noon, you 1 do? Or 2. Let me preface this with, if you're trying to kill that big herd bull.
He's trying to kill a bull. Yeah. You don't give it. This whole conversation, you don't really give a shit.
Just any bull. Yeah. I would still go down there and sit on the edge of that herd, wait for him to get up. He will typically, sometime in the middle of that bedding session, get up and check on all of his cows. So if I can get up, get as close as possible to them without spooking them. If it's a Jack Straw blowdown mess, I might just say, hey, I need him to come back out of there. I'm not going to make it in. But if I can get somewhat close.
I mean, in the timber.
Yeah, if I can get close to that edge or where it's, you know, without being a complete mess and making all kinds of noise and letting them know I'm there, I'll go down there, sneak in if I can keep the wind right.
Like just, sub 200 yards.
Ideally as close as possible. If I can get to 100 yards, great. But if I can get to 150 and be comfortable there, I'm just going to go sit down and wait.
So let's say, you creep down in, you got an uphill wind. There's nice elk trails cutting all through the timber. You start creeping down in there and pretty soon you can just smell them. And it's not the smell of yesterday's elk. It's not elk piss. It's you smell elk.
Yep.
Like living, breathing, there now elk. And you're like, it's got to be that he's 150 yards away. What are you thinking then?
Can I go any further?
How much further?
It just depends. So there's a lot of times where we've spotted the cows before they've spotted us. We used to live by an old saying, not so much anymore, but if you're not bumping elk, you're not hunting elk, but you don't necessarily want to bump every elk you're trying. So it's not a good saying by any means, but I want to be within 100 yards. That way, as soon as he rips a bugle out of his bed, I can walk on top of him.
So you haven't made any noise in a perfect world. You ripped a bugle. He located. You're like, I got you pegged.
Yep. I don't want to make another sound.
You're 100 yards away from the first cow. He's in there somewhere. You don't know where he is, but you can see a cow's ears sticking up. You still haven't made a noise.
Nope. In my opinion, if you try to make elk calls in between them, especially if you're bugling, you could maybe make a cow call and get away with it. But if you're trying to bugle to him, you're basically announcing, hey, I'm a big bull that's going to come down. He'll round up his cows, and it's that cat and mouse game from then on. And I've did it so many times where I don't think he wants the risk of a bull coming down in on him. So
because he already has what he wants.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's trying to, you know, procreate and live, and that's his two in September, that's all that bull wants to do.
Yeah, I'm tracking.
So I don't want to alert him of me coming down. He answered my locator. I was far enough away, it didn't mean anything to him. He doesn't know I'm coming in. And then I'm just going to sit and wait for him to bugle out of his bed. He's going to come check his cows. He does not like satellite bulls to bed anywhere close to him. So if I rip a bugle at that 100 or 125 yard mark, he's going to come. He usually comes and checks you out. He does not want you that close to his bedded cows because he can't necessarily see them all at the same time. So he's kind of just trusting that there's, he's getting up checking them.
Yeah, because they kind of filter into those bedding areas everybody takes their, if they're in a line or in a little ball going into a bedding area, they don't like march in single file and all line up in there.
Yeah,
they mingle around and time goes by and they lay down and get up and lay down and move around. And pretty soon they're just, occupying a wide area. Yeah, you can wind up down. You can sneak down and realize you wound up in the center of them.
Yeah, I mean, you can. This they can bed 80 to 100 yard, you know, in an 800 yard circle and just be scattered everywhere. And you'll notice that when you're just walking through the timber and you're like, yeah, they bedded here last night or two nights ago. And by the time you're done walking up the hill, you're like, they're still bedding. You know, this is that probably that same group. They were just spread all out because there was, you know, piss in the beds. Right. Like, yeah, they were here last night, but yet they were from down there to up here. They're 150 yards scattered up here.
So you've gotten where you snuck down, and like I was saying earlier, like you can see some cow ears or whatever. You're 100 yards away. Can't get any closer, because if you get any closer, you're gonna bump one. You're then gonna, so you're saying then you're gonna do another bugle.
Only after he does. I'm gonna let him lead the game.
Even if you gotta wait.
Yeah, it's very tough. I'm not a very patient hunter, especially if I gotta sit there for 2 or 3 hours. And I'm, you know, if I've seen the ears, I know I'm on the elk, which you could probably get away with the bugle at that point, just because he's gonna most likely wanna come check you out. But in that scenario, I like to let him lead the game off, and then I want to walk right on top of him, you know, or bugle as close to right on top of his bugle as possible.
I've only killed one bull with a bow, and the one bull I killed with a bow, I did just that, found a bedded cow. She was 40 yards away, and I sat there and waited, and eventually the bull, just doing his deal, came over, and I shot him standing above that cow. Like basically came up to stand above her just as he's doing his little thing, you know?
Yep. Comes in. I have a video, some screenshots off of a video last year when we were in Montana on the Land of the Free series with Born and Raised, and those guys, I spotted, it was a nasty day. We were walking through some black timber, just get to the edge of it. And I'm like, well, there's a cow bedded. We sat there and froze to death for like 15 minutes. But then sure enough, middle of the day, that bull, you start to see him working his way through, comes over to the closest cow, bumps her out of her bed, noses her out, and then checks on her. And then that's when I got my shot. But I think now I got lucky, I think, at 15 minutes. I could have been standing there for 2 hours. You know, I just happened to maybe get lucky. That was his time to make his rounds and bump her out and check on her.
So let's say you do, how long would you sit in this scenario we're talking about? The black timber bedded cow, right? How long would you sit before you're like, okay, I'm gonna try something? I'm gonna try a cow call. I'm gonna try something.
It depends. I would like to say sitting here that I would be comfortable enough until the cows get up and started feeding about.
So you're not just. I can't believe that you, as a dude who like lives and breathes game calls, you're not just gonna run in there and start just like meow.
So I have. Even though I love game calls, I like killing elk more. And so I kind of know like when to call it, you know, and just kind of let things play out. That's the same thing. You know, one of my best tactics is instead of just calling them in is more of the ambush and call them in a little bit. You know, so you can call an elk in from a mile, or I can go get in front of the elk going across the mountain, wait for him, maybe call once or twice and kill him. I'll take the ambush and call all day long if that's what I need to do to be effective, instead of saying, oh yeah, I called this bull from a mile away. Like I don't need any awards for, I just want to kill that thing.
Okay. So so you sit there and 2 hours goes by and eventually he bugles. Then what do you do?
I'm going to bugle right back at him at
right
that
on
point.
Top yeah. of him.
Yeah. And I'm trying to paint that picture that, you know, I'm really close to your cows. You're over there somewhere. I can't maybe see you. I'm closer to your cow maybe than you are. You better come take care of me or try to run me off. Like, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about that satellite bull and those bulls spending so much time running them off. At this point, he doesn't have the chance to round his cows up and run away from me. He's got to come try to run me off at this point. Like, it's came to head at that point. And so you're trying to paint that picture. I'm close to your cow. She's right here. I'm right here. Come run me off.
Okay. He bugles. You bugle. He doesn't move.
Maybe bugle again. This is where it gets tough. I mean, sitting here doing a podcast, it's like, well, are the cows making noise? Can I hear sticks breaking? Yeah, there's a bunch of this other stuff that comes in, and you're like, all right, if I probably bugle again, maybe do some excited cow calling, just kind of see how he responds to that. Did that perk his interest? And just kind of see what he does.
Yeah, you need to factor in a ton of things that I can't provide.
Yeah, and that's where it gets tough. You know, even doing these seminars and doing all this stuff, like there are so many
variables.
There are so many things that come in. You know, you teach this prescriptive thing, but you know, if there was something that takes off up the hill after I bugled, then I'm like, you know, but that cow doesn't. What's going on here? There's so many variables.
Let me hit you with another
one. Thing to note here though is that there's like the guys, and I feel like it's kind of become, this is going to go off on a kind of a tangent, but like,
please,
you're the guy that like is going to bugle first almost every single time, right?
Yep.
But there's a lot of dudes, and I feel like that's kind of changed in the last 10 years. So I feel like when I was guiding, like, there was guys that didn't even carry bugle tubes, and there it was just kind of like, nope, you have to call as quietly and as little as possible. Don't even bring the bugle tube. And I almost had to like break out of like and just be like, you know what? I want to just try.
Yeah.
I know you guys are saying this thing, but I just want to at least go out there and try. And like, I got good results. Right. But yeah. Like, speak to a little bit about like why start with, you know, bugling instead of why start with cow calling.
So as far as like when on yeah, that like, same when, scenario,
yeah,
like,
yeah or any,
well,
or
no,
any,
no, let me hit him with another. Let's, I want to bring it out of him through the scenario.
Okay.
So let me try one more scenario. Cause I think that this is going to be a scenario where he's going to cow call. If not, we'll just ask, when do I cow call? But let me just hit you with another scenario. It's pre-morning darkness. You're on a ridge. You know below us there's like a nice lush meadow that they've been hitting. Not even light out. You're like, you know, I'm going to see what's going on down there. You rip a bugle, and lo and behold, sure enough, you get a reply. And because of your familiarity with the area, you're like, they're down in that meadow. I was watching them last night. Now what do you do?
So
are you going to cow call at all today?
I don't know. Right now the wind's probably blowing down to them. So I'm either going to try to get out of my spot or get down the creek on the ridge line. That's going to be my first thing. Like, all right, make sure.
Like, you know, the wind's washing down valley.
Yeah, washing down valley, down slope. So I'm going to try to get below them. And whether that means I got to run down this ridge 400 yards and then I'll be safe and angle down in the creek and then come up on them, whatever I need to do. Pre-morning darkness, I, you know,
almost light out.
Yeah, so you're getting close enough. I'm probably going to try to get to the edge of that meadow, and I'm going to be very careful. A lot of guys set up, and I've did this multiple times, and I kick myself every time I do it, and I'll still do it to this day. I will go set up on the tree that is on the edge of the dang meadow, it, you know, if they're not in the meadow, and try to call them in there, because I can see everything. Well, that elk will, or that bull, when I'm trying to call it in, we'll try to get to the edge, and we've talked about how nature works without us being involved. He'll expect that cow to run across the meadow because he should be able to see him. He should be able to see her. And, you know, we're trying to trick this whole, you know, glitch the game a little bit. So I will try to get wind right on that meadow. And then I will try to walk down the side of the meadow towards the direction he's at on that edge of the meadow and try to be in the timber a little bit and get off the edge of that meadow and try, you know, however these angles work out, try not to call him through that meadow, if that makes any sense. Like,
yeah,
I want to keep him out of open space because that gives him a terrain break or a vegetation break where he thinks he should be able to see me. On that scenario, I may go in and open up with a few cow calls and just see how he responds versus blow him out. If I can get in there, I still want to be close. I'm going to maybe open up with a needy, whiny cow call.
Let me hear it.
So, and this is one thing we talked about, mews, you know, just your normal mew. A lot of times when I elk hunt, and people can say whether there's a such thing as an estrus buzz, I use these real whiny, drawn out up and down cow calls versus
like the
just
estrus cry.
Yeah, your estrus whine is what I call it. You know, there's names for everything, but it's more of an up and down wavy cow call. It's not your perfect cow call, but it's given us good results.
Oh, there's a little waver in there, man.
And so we've had seen cows do that multiple times just watching them, and that bull will typically always go check on her. It's just that whiny, and we've called
I hear that little like, woo, woo, woo.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a flutter, and we've did that in burns where like it's kind of cool calling in a burn because you can see that elk for so long coming in, but it was almost the more we did that, the faster he would run, the slower we would go, the more he would slow down, and we're like, all right, let's just stay on it.
Let me hear it again.
And I'll do it on, this is on the external. I use this a lot for this specific call. So it's just that whiny,
really
drawn out. And then it really, really overemphasized that nasally sound at the end.
And that call might that could be so seductive, so titillating that he would, be like, man, I know I got 3-4 cows out here in my meadow with me, but I'm going to take a mosey over in the woods and see what exactly is up with this newcomer.
Yeah, because he's got a pretty good idea where his cows are at.
But look, in this scenario, do we know there's cows there?
No.
Right?
What you got to say?
I always go into everyone assuming that there's sure. cow, you know, just assume that there's cows. So, but let's say that bull, he's checked on his cows all that morning. He's been with them all night. He knows about where they're at, whether they've already come into the first estrus cycle, whether they're close. He's checking on them all. If that for sure thing and she sounds needy and needs some attention, he's maybe willing to go grab her. And I think that's when people say they cow call bulls, and that's kind of what they're playing on, is that you sound needy enough, or you're, you know, maybe something he should come check out because he knows his other, you know, six ladies aren't ready for any fun, so he's going to come grab her. And so that's kind of why we play that direction.
Let me hit you with this is just something that came to my mind, but it's not really in order of what we're talking about. Have you found a good rule of thumb or anything helpful to explain to people how to tell how far away a bugle is? I remember we started hunting bugling elk. We would oftentimes think they were much farther away than they were. And in going even to get into the zone, wind up stumbling right through the elk, thinking that they had to have been farther away. This is particularly down like big valley bottoms, you know, not where you're like on one slope looking at another slope, but where there's an expanse of like flat country, timbered flat country or whatever. And you hear a thing. Our early thing was that it's much farther away than it actually is. Is that something that is only learned through experience, or do you have a way to explain to people how to tell where a bugle's coming from?
I don't even know if experience helps you. I just, in 2016, I was in New Mexico. So I'll kind of start. I grew up hunting coastal jungle of Southwest Washington. That's all I knew.
Coastal rainforest.
Yeah. So you are chocked full, dense. And in that scenario, that's kind of where I learned how far elk were. They were typically closer than you thought in that scenario. So we kind of got good at judging that until that elk turns 180. If he bugles at you, and if he turns 180 degrees and bugles back at his cows or up the hill the other way, I don't care how good you are, he sounds like he's double the distance or half the distance.
Yeah, you think there's two bulls sometimes.
Yeah, and I'm like, so that is always going after you. And back to the turkey thing, a lot of elk bulls that we call in, especially when you're trying to pull them from their cows, they do that strut zone. They come towards you 100 yards, they bugle, and they will go back. And then you may get them to pull back again, but they will never get past that point. And so you've got this basically elk on a track that's running 100 yards. And so you're trying to judge, you know, whether he's facing you, whether he's 100 yards away. And then in 2016, my eyes really got opened up. I went down to New Mexico and Roley Juniper Country. And being a seasoned elk hunter, I thought, oh, yeah, this elk's right around the corner. And we chased bugles for miles. You could hear a bugle for 2 miles away, plain as day. And we got our butts kicked. I mean, I would say butts kicked from a standpoint that we went a lot further on every bugle we heard versus like, dang, this thing should be a half mile away. No, got this it. Thing's 2 miles away.
Just the vegetation difference.
Yeah, just the vegetation.
The quality of the air too, the moisture in the air.
Yeah, if you know, of course, elevation always helps. If that thing's just sitting up on a point high enough where he can project down that valley, there were a couple times and we looked at it on GPS, like we could be at this water tank and we heard this bull bugle, went up there, called him in, and he was a mile and a half away on the GPS. You know, it's just crazy.
Wow.
Giannis is much better than me at, telling where a gobble or a bugle is coming from. I don't know if it's like a quality of ear thing, right? Like I've been exposed to a lot of like the noise. But he just is more like, I would trust his opinion about was where it was better than my opinion about where it was.
Yeah. We've been walking down a trail, get a bugle, you know, hunt with maybe two or three guys, and all three of us point 120 degrees in different directions. Like, oh boy, we're gonna need another one. We need at least two people, you know, convinced that it's a certain direction. They're just, it's crazy sometimes depending on what you were looking at, where your head was when they bugled, and we're all like that way.
And just a slight roll. If that elk is just over that roll, you know, like even like here, we're sitting next to this gully. That bull will probably sound louder if he's across the gully on the other side than if he's down the bottom just 50 yards below us, just because of that, how that sound is going to travel to your ears, you know?
Yep. Here's another scenario for you. But it's different. You give me your best scenario. Give me the scenario where you're like, I'm going to kill this bull.
Just... a satellite bull feeding on an open hillside first thing in the morning.
Really?
Like I'd have
a lone bull alone. Feeding by himself first thing in the morning.
Well, you said we weren't just killing herd bulls anymore. So if
because we only have so much time, yeah, right? So yeah. I just want to focus it on just elk.
If I've got a semi-mature, maybe 3.5 to 6.5 year old, maybe 3.5 to 5.5 year old bull just feeding first thing in the morning.
By himself,
wind coming downhill and I'm below him. I'll take
that. You're feeling cocky.
I'll take that.
Okay, tell me how you're going to work that bull.
I'm just going to
paint the picture for me.
As long as his eyes can't pick me out, if I can move using terrain or vegetation to get within, even him, I don't even got to get that close now because
you're down below him.
Yep.
Wind's coming down.
Yeah.
Because the day hasn't heated up yet.
First thing in the morning. I know from maybe hunting the area a day or two before, the sun's not going to hit this drainage until now the 2 hours. I've got plenty of time. I just want to get 200, 300, even maybe 400 yards away from this bull and just cow call him in. I won't even touch my bugle.
So then you're not worried about getting 100 yards away?
No, I know from past experience that we can pull that thing with a lot of heavy, sexy cow calls from a lot further away.
Okay, so give me the... So there you are. You're down in the creek bed, but it's an open slope, and you're looking up, and you can just see him working around feeding.
Yep.
And he's 300 yards up the hill.
And I want to be able to see him. If I can see him and see how he reacts to the calls, the better.
Right. What do you zap him with first? Do you start heavy duty or you just take his temperature first?
I'll probably just some light cow calls, just see how he responds.
Let's hear it.
Once he gets going, then I'll probably pick it up.
So this is the first noise out of your mouth.
And just maybe those two.
And then you watch him.
Just watch him. He's most likely going to pick his head up. And then his next step's either going to be go back to feeding or he's going to turn and come down towards me. Once he turns and comes down to me, and I don't want to be cocky, but at that point, I would say we have a 99.9% chance he's going to come.
Hold on. Okay, when do you feel that it's 99%?
Once he takes that first step in your direction. So if he was feeding left to right and he goes from straight down the hill, I would be pretty confident that at least we're going to get a shot at him.
What's your cockiness level just seeing him?
I prefer confidence. So confidence level.
It's
50 yards. I'll just set that at 50 yards. I'm going to say we got a 90% chance that he.
No. I'm saying like when he's still 300 yards up the hill, but like, for absolute, it might not be possible in real life. Let's just say you knew for absolute certain that is a lone bull by himself and the wind's right and you're 300 yards below it. And we know that it's the rut. Are you thinking, man, there's a, before I even touch this call, I'm saying there's a blank percent chance that bull's going to step in my direction.
90.
Oh, really?
If I can see him from across the canyon, know he's all by himself feeding. And I would say that number is pretty similar, even because a lot of times these satellite bulls will kind of herd up together and hang out. I would say even if you have a group, it's still probably 85% one of them or two of them are going to break off.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe the more mature out of those two, or if there's a couple that are maybe a little bit better than the spikes or the 2.5 year olds, typically those bigger ones in the group will break off and come towards you, sometimes together.
So let's say you're on a glass and knob or just a ridge. And on one side, down one side of the ridge, you've got, and all these bulls are the exact same size in this scenario. They're all the exact same size. But on one side of the ridge, you've got 20 cows, there's 7 bulls. Everybody's going bananas, okay? On the other side of the bridge is just the same bull, but he's just hanging out feeding. You're like, I'm going to go work that bull.
Now you're really playing with the reason I elk hunt. So you've got all that action on the one side, and that's what I'm here for. So now I need to weigh, is killing the bull more important, or am I here for that action
to throw in.
So that's where it gets really tough. Now you've kind of split me down the middle. Cause even though I love filling the freezer full of elk meat, it's, that's what I came out here for. I also come out here for something a little different, like that action.
Like you're like, I want to go in and throw in with that group and get involved. And
so even though I know there's probably better, well, that many bulls running around with 20 cows, there's still gonna be a lot of action. You're probably gonna have a chance, but that satellite bull is going to be pretty good odds.
Right. And then you have the 50 sets of eyes versus the one set of eyes, that always helps.
But you're seduced by the action.
It is. It's
in the learning experience and everything.
Yeah. So I'm probably bailing towards the bugles just because it's going to be funner. I can go down there and bugle a little bit more. And then I'm also thinking in the back of my head, like, I screw this up, I can go after that one later.
Yeah, I'll find him tomorrow.
Yeah.
Oh, or eventually he's probably going to come on over to the join the party anyways. Yeah.
Give me another. Okay, now hit me with, this is make your own scenario. Hit me with a great scenario that involves cows.
Cow calling? Or
no, this involves like, because you're saying like, okay, it's a bull, 2-3 bulls, whatever, no cows around, out feeding. So let's say it is that it's a big herd bull. He's got 5 cows, seems to have some like spike in the mix, seems to have some raghorn bull in the mix who are kind of pestering him. What is the moment throughout the day or the moment when you're like, now's my, like, if I'm going to make this work, I'm going to make it work when X happens.
I want to catch them if I can, the most optimum time, if I can catch them when they're going through from feed back into their bedding cover, I want to be somewhere in that 100 to 200 yard range of the cover. So they just come out of maybe feeding in an open meadow and an old burn and an avalanche chute, whatever that area is their feed, and they're going back to bed. I would love to catch them in that 100 to 300 yards inside like
that
timber.
You're waiting in there.
That's where that ambush slash, a little bit of calling comes in. Like, all right, I've watched them this morning. It was right at daybreak. I had an hour and a half to get up. I know they're going to feed in about on contour. They're going to go to that bench. You know, I'm drawing all this up in my mind where I think they're going to go. If I don't have any past experience, I'm going to go sit right there, 100, 200 yards inside that timber and wait for them and just do some real minor calling.
When you hear them, see them?
See them, hear them. Yeah, I'm pretty impatient, so I might start to move around a little bit, trying to figure. Hopefully, ideally, that bull's maybe making some sounds on his own in the morning. If not, I might let a cow call out here or there if I kind of think I lost them or they should be here by now.
I got you.
I feel like the cows, a lot of times, you get that sort of like tea party almost. We used to always call it when they're leaving that big
like
meadow.
Like Boston tea party, and, not like the tea party.
No, like a bunch of like gals at a tea party just yakking away, talking over each other.
Throwing tea into Boston Harbor or electing right of center anti-establishment politicians or
neither of those two
people drinking tea at a party.
Should have been more clear, but almost like a cacophony. And really, a lot of times there's not even that much bugling, but those cows are just, as they're moving up towards bed, they're just going off.
And I love to have calves in the herd. Like if I can look cross, I got two or three calves. Like, them little noisy suckers are going to let me know they're coming.
They're
pretty vocal, especially the moms. Once they start moving like that, the moms will talk to them because they're not always right next to each other. And so there's a lot of, cow to calf communication. Just as they move, they start their journey back to bed and they'll be pretty vocal.
Let me hit you with another scenario. This isn't a make your own. I'm giving you this one.
All right.
Okay. Whatever the hell happened, you have your morning hunt. Gets all hot. You just know nothing's going to happen. You're headed back toward camp. You're passing through a timber patch. Okay. Unfamiliar terrain. And all of a sudden surprises you. But all of a sudden, 100 yards off, down below you, in the timber, a bugle. So you have no context. You have no idea.
Just
you don't know what way it's going.
He did it all on his
own.
You
don't know who it's with. You don't know anything.
I'm going to start that one with cow calls.
Right where you stand.
Yeah. See if he answers back to that. He might ignore me. Or at least where is he at on cow calls? Is that going to work? 100 yards away, I should be able to hear some sticks breaking if I can't see him. If he's coming towards me, if he doesn't respond, a lot of times they will come in silent too. So you got to, can I hear sticks? But I'm going to start that one with a cow call. I figured on those, I don't have a whole lot to lose. If he doesn't answer, so maybe 5-10 minutes if nothing develops or I can't hear anything moving, I might just do a little weak little bugle. Just something. Knowing he can hear it because he's close. Just trying to get a response so I can kind of gauge whether he went the other way, whether he was in his bed, if he's still in his bed.
Yep.
Did he move towards me?
Let me hear the cow calls and let me hear the light bugle. Oh, just a real nice little light.
Knowing that he can hear it. When you're trying to locate, I'm trying to be as loud as possible to kind of hit as many ears. But yeah, just something really kind of in the middle, not getting really high. Just how's he going to respond to that?
But that's your softest cow call.
No, that's a fairly heavy bugling reed. We've got some really light. Make sure I get. So that's the other thing. I hunt with one call. So the
really
my I this is my personal call and I use it for almost everything.
What's that one called?
This is the Phelps signature. So it's just
and that's what you've been ripping the bugles on.
Well, I've been using the Maverick as well too. So those are the two that I typically use. But mine's a little bit softer on the cow call.
See, I don't think of that as a soft cow call, man.
So I guess
I mean, who am I to say? But that strikes me as like a that's a cow call.
It I mean, we can go really soft, but by the time you're trying to call through the trees and the vegetation, if you got somebody like, you know, we've called a lot for our buddies and like, dang, them things get drowned out pretty quick. We're not near as loud.
You hear cows just making like, you hear cows just making the slightest little sounds. Yeah.
It depends. You know,
that's not really in your hunting repertoire though.
Not the calls that I make. I'll never argue they don't make them.
You know, that's what I'm saying. Like, subtle, for you as a hunter, you don't need that.
Yeah, I don't use it. I will calf call, which is more of that high pitched chirp if I'm trying to communicate with the calf.
Let me hear your what a calf. Okay.
So they don't really have the deep part to their call. It's just more of that high pitch shut off. I'll calf call a little bit, but yeah, most of my cow calling is loud. And during September, it seems they will communicate softly, but a lot of times, you know, the whole tea party, when they get going, they're fairly loud, obnoxious, like, yeah, they got those loud drawn out cow calls and they get going. And it's like, well, that's what I want to be one of them. Right. And so
I got you.
Like last year, the bull that my wife called in, there were probably 40 cows in that herd with a couple different bulls and then the one larger bull. And when they got up to feed, that we kind of shadowed them the whole morning or the evening, excuse me. And they started to come up. They just started going and it sounded like 1,000, you know, different elk going off because it was bouncing off the walls and they were all doing loud. It was pretty impressive. Just the amount of sound and noise and volume that group of 40 cows could make. It's like, as many cow calls and as fast as they could go, they were letting them fly.
That makes me want to hit you with another scenario. Okay. You hunt all morning, right? You're all dejected. Nothing happened. You get into a shady spot. You decide to have it's 11 a.m. You decide to have a sandwich. Okay. You decide to take a little nap. You're fighting the urge to go home. Everything sucks. And all of a sudden you hear a bunch of sticks snapping, rocks rolling, and for whatever the hell reason, off to your side a ways, here comes just a herd of elk. You can't tell, are they spooked? Are they what? What's going on? But they're just kind of bam, rumbling down the hillside. Maybe they got bumped, maybe whatever. I don't know. Maybe the bull's harassing them. They're going to pass out of range. Do you just watch them go and be like, huh, that was interesting? Or do you be like, I'm going to make some kind of crazy play?
I might try to cow call, slow them down, but I'm not going to necessarily chase that herd as they run away. You know, if they were just passing through fairly quickly, we'll just kind of let them go. But
and just log in your head where they went.
Yeah, yeah. Though, you know, was able to see what was there. Could you know? I might try to get up, grab my bow, and release and cut them off. Maybe to have a shot if there is a bull there I want to kill. But you know, if they're moving like that, it's going to be tough. Tough to call them in because they're going somewhere. They've been scared by something, or you know, there was a predator or a human or. It's going to be tough to call them in.
Okay, let me hit you with one more. Then you can hit me with a scenario if you want. It's evening time. It's your last day of the hunt, okay? And there's just a gigantic open sage flat. Very open. And just out in the middle of this thing.
Like 1,000 yards across.
Yeah. And out in the middle of this thing is a couple bulls, a bunch of cows, and they're just happily feeding away. With a rifle, you'd be loving.
Yep.
But they're not going anywhere. They're going to be out there till morning. It's your last night. You can't, it's not really plausible to do a good sneak on them. And you're like, I don't know. I got to try something. I can't just let this, right? I can't just let this one pass.
And it's all you got last night.
Yeah. And you can't get 300 yards away without spooking them.
You're gonna have to try to call them in. See, it's just that you know, take their temperature as soon as you let that first probably cow call, really loud cow calls if they're 300 yards away.
What's your percent chance?
Not good. 10.
Oh, really?
Under 10.
So you're just like, I don't know.
I'm pretty
under 10.
Yeah, I'm not liking my odds on this one, but you got to try something.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you got enough time left in the night to go find something else.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So if you had enough time to go find something else, you might be like,
well, I'm probably going to try to screw this up as fast as possible
to get
and,
out of
and then go find something else. That way I say at least I gave it a shot.
Yeah.
That's tough. I usually like to put, and maybe I shouldn't put a number on it, but I'm pretty confident that in the mountains and normal hunting, I'm going to get to at least see 75 to 85% of the bulls I hear, you know, at a fairly close range, maybe not all within archery range, but I'm going to see them in the timber, like at a point where I've called them into a spot or I've snuck into a point, something like that. Like I'm probably going to see them at the closest point I'm going to see them as they're walking away. Like, I'm not going to probably turn that bull. I'm not going to get him to turn around.
But you'd hit it with a cow call.
Probably just see what he's...
See if something crazy happens.
Yeah.
Do you always, with every group you work, with every group elk you work, are you like, I'm either going to call it or spook it? Or do you sometimes just say like, I'll find you tomorrow?
So I have a trophy hunter's mentality with a meat hunter's trigger finger.
Yep.
And so I just want to kill elk, but there have been a couple occasions when the headgear has gotten me to a point like, I'm not going to screw this one up yet. I've got 10 days left in season. This bull is a giant. I'm going to give him one more, you know, or a couple more chances before I blow him out of the country into a different drainage, into a spot he's not familiar with. Now, that's not always bad. Sometimes I would rather hunt a bull after I spook it so he's not as comfortable in his surroundings. But most of the time I'm going to bump him. And a lot of times when we bump them, they haven't necessarily smelled us. In my opinion, them smelling us is our, we've kind of screwed that up for a while. If they just see us or hear us, I'd rather them see me personally walking towards them than to smell me.
That's the thing I've said to people a lot is like, I feel that they don't always trust their eyes and they don't always trust their ears, but they always trust their nose.
Yep. And even their ears. So like, well, you call to them a specific way. Like my buddies, they can all tell if it's me calling. I can tell which one of my buddies is calling. We all have our own little unique style. And I'm always like, the elk, can they tell? Like, do I need to switch calls? Do I need to switch my style? Cause I was calling to them that way last night. And then they seen, you know, me walking through the woods with my bow and my pack towards them. Like, did they associate my calling with that? So if we go get on them again, do we need to switch? Uh-huh. I don't know if I'm smart enough or like, we will just because we have a different call. Or like say, hey, I was shooter last time, but we're going after the same group. I'll call, you shoot this time just to give them a little bit different of a style. But I also believe if you sound enough like an elk and a quality enough sounds, then does it really matter? Because elk always are going to sound like elk. So can you fool them again the next day? And we have, but I would just assume going with a little bit different sound.
Do you guys ever, you and your buddies, do you guys ever tag team on calling? Is that advantageous?
Especially when the multiple cows get going and they're creating some excitement and we feel like we're losing some excitement to what the bull already has, we'll get going back and forth. To pick it up. We don't do the primo style, like guy drops 100 yards back calling style though, because the way we hunt, that caller, which is now the elk, so to speak, is now 200 yards away from this bull. And that might give him the chance to leave dodge because the elk he thinks there isn't a threat. That bull will maybe round his cows up and leave. So a lot of times that caller is right on my hip and it gives us a chance to communicate like, hey, I can see something he can't, like stop bugling,
right.
Stop cow calling. Well, if he's 100 yards back, you know, I love all the truth videos. I watched them all 100 times, but the way that we have to hunt on public lands isn't the same as they got to hunt on the Hill Ranch.
You know, that's a funny thing, man. Cause I was talking to a guy last night, a buddy of mine, and he was talking about this world record elk and it was like, everybody knew it was there and they'd filmed it. Eventually a guide finds it. It's hiding out in some private land hidey hole. They call a client on the phone. He books a trip to come out. It's like, that's all great and good, but that's not reality, man.
Yep.
You know what I mean? It's just not reality.
Yeah, that's...
That's called cash.
Yeah, and yeah, so we... As much as I love those, it's just sending the caller way back has just never worked well for us. A lot of times, and to this day, my buddy Charlie did call me in a bull, but to this day, I've still called in every bull I've shot. Like I've never, and when we do call for each other, we're usually right in each other's hip pockets, and it's really to create that threat to that bull. Like I'm here, I'm on top of you, I'm on your cows. You have to come running.
You guys are like. bugling so much more,
yeah.
which is why you probably have to maintain that,
yeah,
that
we're,
pressure distance.
If we had to put a number, I know Steve loves numbers. Like if I had to put like a...
No, man, I don't.
No, if I had to put a... I'm like 90% beagles, 10% cow
calls. There's two kinds of people.
90% beagles from the day I leave the truck to the time I get back in September to 10% cow calls, I would say probably represents
what
I...
You rip 9 bugles for every cow call.
For every 10 cow calls. Yep, 90 to 10, 9 bugles for every 1 cow. Especially when we're locating.
No shit, really?
I mean, we may let it, maybe I'm a little off on my numbers. I might cow call just to say I did before I rip a bugle. But usually I'm going to maybe cow call twice from a spot and then I'll rip a, I really want to locate from this spot.
And are you, do you mostly hunt in high pressure areas?
High pressure units? I try to get into some areas within those high pressure units maybe that don't have as many people. The spot we, you know, we hunt Idaho. We hunt. I haven't hunted Washington for a while now. Montana. We hunt a lot. We're in units where there's lots of people down by the road. But if we get 2 or 3 miles in, we're typically fairly alone. But you might run into a hunter or two or a sure, set of man, boot yeah. tracks here or there. But there's a lot of hunters around, and these elk may have been called to. But it's yeah. If there are a lot of hunters, I might not locate bugle as much. And that's one of those other things.
Like, you drawing in hunters.
Yeah, you can't even factor in. Like, if you're in a high pressure area, like, do I tone my location beagle back? Because, you know, everybody within 2 miles can hear me up on this ridgeline. And I don't necessarily want everybody on my ridgeline, you know, or I say mine, or on the ridgeline at the same time I am. So you're like, well, maybe I just cow call the locator. Maybe I tailor back or cut back my location beagle so not everybody knows I'm here. Or you get into a pass on a ridgeline, there's been elk here, like I'll start to pick my points a little bit more wisely, like, all right, I can smell them, I can see their tracks, we'll bugle from here, but then I might not bugle until I'm out at the end of the ridge next.
We had a time hunting, me and my brother, where we were hearing this bull just going nuts, but it was like the one road in the area, and it was like calling from the road, the ridge that the road is on, and I'm like, dude, that's a guy, you know? And we argued about it. And he's like, that's an elk. I'm like, it's a guy. And then let's just go. So we start walking down the road and pretty soon walked into a group of elk.
Yep.
It can be hard to tell, man.
I take a lot of pride just because of how you own the call company. I don't ever want to get called in by somebody. And there's been multiple times where I was about ready to bail. And my buddy's like, let's just hang it out a little bit. They won't know who we are. We could sneak out of here. And sure enough, we call a bull or a whole herd in multiple times. And so now I'm a little more likely to hang it out. Like, well,
even you could be fooled.
Yeah, your pride might be hurt a little bit, but is it really worth, you know, risking not getting a chance at this bull because you think it's a person? So yeah. I'd rather hurt my pride a little bit.
You generally know.
Yeah, you do. And I've called a ton of bulls in with my Primos Terminator too. But like now, if I hear that thing, you know, flute across the canyon, like I know exactly what that is.
You know the make and model.
Yeah, it may still fool a bull, but I can pick a Primos Terminator out, you know, almost anywhere at any time. Even most people call it that are even some that are good on diaphragms. Like there's just some things they can't mimic. Even I can't mimic from a real bull, like the depth, the guttural sound. If you listen closely enough, sometimes you're like, ah, it's a person. But then there's some really bad sounding elk that sound bad and they're real. So it's just tough. It's tough to pick out. We try to spend all this time sounding as good as we can, but in reality, the elk are a lot of times worse than what we think you're supposed to sound
bad
like.
Callers.
Yeah, yeah.
what's your, I don't know if you got one or two or three or whatever, but like your deathbed elk tips. Like your elk tips that sum it all up, where you're saying like, man, if I could tell you one thing or two things that are just generally applicable around elk calling, what would it be?
Okay, I'll give you three.
Okay.
First is setup. I get the chance, and I call it the fortune of listening to a lot of bad elk hunters. You know, in the position I'm in, like, hey, your calls were awesome. I called these bulls into this, and then I didn't get a shot. So number one, when you set up, whatever direction that bull is going to come from, make sure when he shows himself, either through vegetation or if it's on a terrain break coming up the hill to a plateau, make sure you're within bow range of where that break terrain or vegetation's at to make sure that you get a shot.
That's your setup.
So many people can do everything else right, but so many, I think, fail on this setup. They want to set up in a pile of brush or they want to set up 100 yards away from this spot. And as we talked, in reality, that bull's going to get to that spot, say that I should be able to see you somewhere out here, and he is going to stop. And that is that hold up position.
It's funny you mention that, because that was my dad's like big elk story. You know, he's from Michigan, but he went out to Colorado to do an elk hunt with my older half brother, and they had a bull working. And he said, I never thought about the fact that I had to shoot the bull. And he climbed into a tree, not into a tree, but like nestled into a tree. And the bull came 10 yards away, and he realized that that's the thing he forgot.
Yep.
That he has to be able to shoot his bow.
You jump in a pile of brush, you realize you got 25 inches of arrow sticking out front. You got a stabilizer sometimes. And if that thing doesn't come where you want, you got to try to swing in there. And you got your elbow, your pack getting hooked on brush. It's just, so yeah, I set up out in the open, let the, you know, the terrain break me up behind, but really just get close to that terrain break vegetation break.
I got burned. It's funny, because nothing like mule deer hunting in Nevada 2 years ago. I got where I had these bucks coming up, and I'd snuck in on them, and I was up against a bush, and I committed where I had my bow on one side, right? Didn't get a shot when they passed through, but then they're super close, and there was no way without doing major movement to be able to get my bow to the other side of that, and trying to do it spooked the bucks.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm 100% in on this angle, and I'm 100% out on every other angle.
Yep. Or just stupid stuff. As a right-handed guy, I can't turn to my right at all, right? We can't. And there's been multiple times where like you expect the bull to go to the left and he goes to your right, and you're like, uh-oh, like I'm going to have a lot of movement here, because I got to actually now move my feet around. He's at 25 yards, because I can swing way back to my left and still shoot with decent form. But to my right, I'm like, you know, you're stuck. And so all of that on setup, like stuff I used to not think about until it cost me a lot of times.
Yeah, you're like, keep adding to the setup thing forever. But my little tidbit on that is that we used to see a lot of guys, like, they want to crouch and get low. And like you're saying, people would get like inside of like the branches of a fir tree. I'm like, dude, how are you ever going to get your bow drawn back? But I think a big thing is always stay on your feet.
Yep.
Don't kneel. Don't crouch down. Like, just trust that your camo is going to work. Stay on your feet, because that just gives you so much more, like, you can take a step, and that might be that gets you the 6 inches for the window you need, right?
Yeah.
And if you're on your knees, you're not doing that.
Do you always stay on your feet?
I do. I was just getting, somebody asked me the other day in a seminar, like, how many, I've killed one bull off of my knees out of however many, I've, you know, 30 plus bulls I've killed. You know, archery, I've been on my knees like one time. And that ended up being like a 6 yard shot. And the only reason I killed him off of my knees, I wasn't supposed to be the shooter. I kind of carved my buddy. I was calling the bull in for him. He got to like 4 yards of my buddy, but had him pinned. And you could tell by his actions, he was going to get nervous and leave. And I'm like, well, I'm only 8 yards away, and I've got a bow and I've got a tag. So I actually knocked my arrow with him 8 yards away, and as the cameraman shot him. But, that's the only one I've ever killed off of my knees. And that's because it was an accident.
So you're like making a little sacrifice on hiding in order to get an advantage in mobility and good shot form.
Yep. But and this is the goofiest rule ever. I don't ever look at elk in the eye. As long as you don't look at elk in the
just
eye.
Just one of your three tips?
No. This is bonus. Don't look them in the eyes. Like, I've never had an elk pick me out as long as I haven't looked them in. It seems like you make an eye connection and something weird happens and they know. But if I keep my brim and my hat down, I've never been picked off by an elk. I mean, I know they're smart, they can see good, but in that setup, like, as long as I don't move and like make eye contact with them, we're good.
Yeah.
Number two is, if you're struggling, don't commit to spot number eight, you know, Google Earth, Onyx Maps. And don't be afraid. It's kind of a combo. Get out and use the nighttime to night locate. Everybody wants to be in bed, eat dinner. The magical hour, if you cannot get something going, go out and bugle from 10 o'clock to midnight somewhere in your unit. And I guarantee you have a play or two or three or four for the next morning. I'm like, hey, I'd much rather take a nap under a tree from 10 to noon if nothing's going on, right? Save my energy, eat dinner, and then either go drive around, go hike a ridge out, go hike a trail, and just rip bugles from 10 to 12. And I guarantee
10 a.m. to midnight.
No,
10 at night. Oh. So night bugle. So I'm going to take my nap in the midday instead of hunt to make sure I'm not tired, but I'm going to go bugle from 10 at night to maybe midnight.
Yeah, I got you. So you'd rather sleep 10 a.m. to noon in order to make up for the fact that you're out bugling 10 p.m. Yep. to midnight.
Make sure when you get one to respond, do not resist the urge to keep bugling and getting him to sound off. Just it's
as
night.
As it is.
You cannot do anything about it. You know he's there. He's nobody else is crazy enough to be you out bugling at night. You've got him located. Typically, he will be within 400 or 500 yards max of that area. He's usually out to feed then. He'll be there in the morning. It gives you a for sure play. Because we only got so many days and mornings, you want to make sure you have a play every morning and almost every night. So that guarantees I'm at least on an elk that next morning.
Okay. Was that a side tip or a tip?
That was one of my tips. It's not necessarily a do this, but it's something that everybody should be doing unless you're just covered up in bulls all day long, then there's no need to do it. Number three, it all comes down to wind. We're back to setup, and this is really where...
Setup and approach.
Yeah, I think everybody fails in that setup, but the wind, we always get the wind right, and if you have the wind perfect on your nose, that bull is typically going to come in straight on. If you can use the wind as a steering wheel to help yourself out, so if I have the wind that hits, say, my cheek at a 30 or 45 degree angle, I still got plenty of conservancy built into my setup. But I'm now just guaranteed that if I'm facing the bull, the wind's hitting me in the right cheek, that bull is now going to come to my left. And we'll sometimes...
Because he wants to circle downwind.
He wants to get wind on you. And so a lot of times we'll even make a call and then move a little bit. So we'll make a call and then move into the wind. So we know that he's going to basically J-hook or, half moon right into us. So that's something in the setup. Or if you have a collar, say that same wind's hit my right cheek. If that collar backs up maybe just 15 yards to my 4 o'clock, my 3:30 from where I'm located, he's going to drag that bull right into me. Now, albeit we can't control whether that bull wants to make a 150-yard circle, 100-yard circle, or a 50-yard circle, it still may not be enough, but I can at least guarantee that bull, guarantee most of the time that bull is going to come broadside through my shooter's location.
Yeah.
Just for setup, and that's going to help a lot of times because I honestly think a lot of hunters out there, they've got the locating down. They're in good areas. They can do everything right. They can even call decent enough to call these things in. They just fail at the setup, and you hear these story after story, everything nuts. I just couldn't get a shot all year.
Kept calling bulls and couldn't get a shot.
Yeah, either hang-ups or just stuff's not working, and so I really think it comes down to that setup and then using the wind to get them to a spot where you can get a shot.
Any last thoughts?
No, we're going to talk. You could do a good elk tag this year.
Yeah.
And I got a quick question. Just how do I get that higher pitch you're talking about? It's going to help me get more locators. What do I need to do?
So as a caller, there's two factors that play into there's air that you can put across the reed and there's pressure you can apply with your tongue.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, and a lot of us call it the balance of that. You're applying a little bit of both. So you're going to want either more pressure, but if that locks a call out,
right,
you need to. You
it
maybe
breaks.
You
like
maybe
when you say locks out. You like breaks. Yeah, and all of a sudden you lose your. You lose that note.
Yep. So then you're like, well, all right, I can't add any more pressure. I need to just put more air across. If that doesn't work, I would highly recommend moving the call in your mouth a little bit, either forward or back, and finding a spot that maybe allows some pressure to hit it a little bit different.
Can I give you one? See if you can tell me which one I need to do.
So this is Yanni ripping a bugle.
Brand new Phelps.
Out of the package.
Signature series. Out of the package.
Brand new Phelps tube.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like these bugling tubes that are like a smaller, more packable tube.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times you look at the damn tube, right?
You're like, man, dude, you can carry this thing in your cargo pocket.
Yeah.
That's where mine might be.
It fits in. I designed it to be the same size.
Oh.
It will fit in a normal, this is a small water bottle.
Oh, you
pocket.
Made it so it'll fit in a water bottle holder on a backpack.
Yep. And then you don't even need anything else attached. It'll literally just stuff in a water
What's
bottle.
What's this new little one called?
The Unrivaled Tube.
Unrivaled Tube.
Unrivaled.
All right, here we go.
Let me tell you a good Giannis story. We're hunting out down in Kentucky.
Loud enough? High enough?
I don't know if it was the reed. The one you bugled on before this started hit a lower pitch, but that one seemed to definitely go high enough.
Well, yeah, that one, it's a year old reed.
Yeah,
it's been used a lot.
That was good. Really? Yeah, you probably made me just sound bad.
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
Let me tell you Yanni's story. We're hunting elk in Kentucky, and one day we're just out, and it's kind of got like middle of the day doldrums, And we sat and like ate lunch, because we were just in checking out this other area that we weren't even like serious about. We just happened to wander into this area to see what's going on. Sat and ate lunch, shooting the shit, okay? And then he just decides to rip a bugle more just like whatever.
And all of a sudden, an elk walks into us. He'd been laying there listening to our conversation.
And just comes right in.
And then here's
special Kentucky elk.
And here's a bugle, and all of a sudden stands up, and all of a sudden someone hears a noise, and the elk just walks up to us.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of lunch. Matter of fact, that 2000.
A lot of lunch bowls.
A lot of lunch bowls or nap bowls where we're just napping, and like one of us, like, do you hear that? That was a raven. No, it wasn't. Get up. Maybe let a little cow call, and then he hammers back. You're like, oh, shoot. You know, and everybody's running to get set up. But we've called multiple bulls lunch. You're just, because you're a little more, you're just listening, hanging out, and you get a bull to answer, and you'll call them in right there where you're eating lunch. It's just, it's crazy, you know, when and how. But that midday, if you can get a bull to answer 10 to 2, your chances are good.
It's just like hunting turkeys.
Gosh, I was going to say.
Sounds like you're hunting turkeys.
Sorry, yeah. Remy.
A quick question on this this tube. Why is it not just a straight pipe on the end? Why does it roll in? Is that for like reverberation?
For back pressure.
Back pressure.
So you can take a 1.5-inch diameter PVC pipe and blow through it, but there's no resistance. No, you can go down to a 1-inch and there's no resistance, or 3/4. Or you can take like my big tube or that new Unrivaled tube that's a 4-inch diameter tube, and you have to blow a quarter of the air through this as you do a 1-inch piece of PVC pipe. It all has to do with the back pressure. And what that does is when you get up and grab that high note that we were just talking about, it just kind of sits there for you. It's easy to hold that note instead of wavering, versus if I had, you know, a straight piece of corrugated pipe, it's very, very difficult even for a guy like myself that can control that high note to sit there and hold it and put enough air across that. So that's why we kind of, you know, one of the things we've did on both these tubes is we kind of overcupped the end to provide the right amount of back pressure. On the little tube, it was a little more difficult because you don't want to give up too much volume. The smaller you make that hole, the less volume you get out of it. So it's kind of a balance of let's make sure there's enough back pressure that we can run the call versus still get enough volume that it's effective enough to pack around in the woods.
And you're just selling calls like a mofo right now. Like people are ordering right now.
People are
thinking about it.
It's awesome. I can't say anything else. My wife and mom, I think, are ready for the middle of October since they're managing most of it. But it's been an incredible year for us.
When do people start getting fired up about buying calls, and when do they kind of forget about it?
July, I always say the 4th of July is kind of the big bump, and we can see it in our numbers for the last 4 years.
People light off all their fireworks, yeah, and then go buy an elk call.
They're ready. You see a little bit of a bump, you know, when the draws start, but draws are kind of all across the board. So
people start pulling tags and ordering calls.
Yeah, they get serious all of a sudden. July and August have always been our best month. So August has been the best month the last 2 years. So it's right now is really at the height of, and then you've got the difference in we sell to vendors versus selling off of our website. The vendors have already kind of preloaded a lot of their stuff. They needed it in the store.
I was thinking about the difference in them.
So the vendors may start to tail off a little bit where our website, they're kind of crossing. So it's been good. I'm ready for September though. I'm not going to lie.
To go hunting.
Yeah. To take off.
Jason Phelps, Phelps Game Calls. As usual, thank you for coming on, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's always very informative.